Good morning. This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back to the program a guest who's been here before on the show, Larry Lister. His business is Facility Dynamics Engineering. He's an engineer. He's particularly interested in energy efficiency in design, construction, operation of buildings, and in some cases, really big buildings. But when he's on the program here, we scale down a little bit and we talk about the issue of energy in the home, where most of the energy goes, how it is sometimes we waste it, what we can do about that so you can, depending on whatever this, what the season is, keep your place comfortable, warm in the winter, cool in the summer, and do what you can to keep the bills, utility bills, as low as possible. And we thought this would probably be a good time to have him on the program as it has been kind of a long, cold winter. And we've had some pretty shocking utility bills, all of us. And so we thought now this would probably be the guy that people would like to talk to. So if you have questions, you can call us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. So how's stuff going at your house?
Hey, David. Okay. I got to get this off my chest.
Confession's good for the soul. Yeah.
Forgive me, David. I had a listen up, everybody. I had a $700 heating bill, Mr. Energy Efficiency. But hey, it happens to everybody. I've got caveats on that if anybody ever wants to get into it. But I did have a $700 for 1 month heating bill. There was an estimated payment the month before, which I think they underestimated. And I think a lot of us got that because of snowfall. There was a lot of snow on the ground, so they came through and they did an estimate. They underestimated. Natural gas prices just went crazy. And that all combined to really shock people. Now, I'm sure I've heard of one other person who had one bigger than me. Now, I've got like a
I have a pretty good sized house.
An ordinately large house. And it's an old house. Yeah. So, you know, all these things that we talk about the air leakage. The other thing that's going on at my house, just to flush out the story here, is that I'm in the middle of doing a major gut and remodel of a large kitchen. And the house was open because I had it open because we were hauling out plaster and all kinds of things like that. But on the other hand, all these surprises that I tend to warn people about and talk about, I was finding them on an almost daily basis. I'm tearing the walls out of my house, and I've got snow blowing me in the face in my kitchen coming from the north side of the house, which is 20 feet away. And I thought, what's going on here? And I've got snow blowing through between my first and second floor of my house because of a problem on the front porch. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, my kitchen job gets drug into being a front porch job. And did some, but the good news is that allows us the chance whenever you do a remodeling job, as I've said a couple times before, any remodeling job is a great time to go after energy efficiency.
Yeah. Well, that's the difficulty, I guess, the challenge in thinking about when you're looking at your house as is, what do you do if you're not going to go around pulling off the interior walls so you can actually see what's going on in there? How do you, you have the opportunity to see things that you would not ordinarily see.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay, pulling off walls is a little radical.
Yeah, a little bit.
Not at our house, but yeah, yeah, it is. Well, yeah, there's a good segue into something is how do you see the things that you can't see? And there are things like thermographic, ultraviolet cameras, infrared cameras, I should say, I'm sorry. Things like that, and you know, those kinds of services used to be around in the late 70s and early 80s. And then once energy prices got cheaper and then later on the economy gets better, those services and people that provide some of those services sort of went by the wayside. And it's really been funny this last 3 or 4 months. I'm seeing all kinds of potential new service providers showing up locally and nationally in different areas. The infrared camera is one nice thing where people can come out with a video camera, which has gotten a lot smaller. It used to be they were liquid nitrogen cooled and all kinds of things. Now they're sort of like little handheld video cameras, and they can come over and take a picture of your house at night usually at night they get the better pictures that way when it's cold. And you can see these flares. They look like flares coming out of areas of the house that are losing heat, and you can see where the heat's being lost. And those kinds of services, I keep thinking, you know, if these energy prices stick the way they are, the way they could here, I think that that kind of stuff's going to start happening. And it's going to be an incentive to do energy efficiency.
Hmm.
And you know, I've gotten in trouble in the past by whenever we need callers, I'll just throw out some kind of comment like, I think energy prices are way too low. Gas should be $4 a gallon and natural gas should be a buck a thermal. Now it is. And I'm not sure if I was glad I said it or not.
So you're the guy who was responsible.
Yeah, I think I'm the one.
Well, so, if short of having somebody come do an energy audit and actually do that, go around and look at the house, would there be places where you would say, I would bet that when you find out where the problems really are, 8 out of 10 times or 7 out of 10 times, I can point to you where I'll bet you would see energy loss if we actually had someone come in here and do it.
Right.
Where are those places?
Yeah, those places are usually higher and lower in the house than what you expect. We all tend to feel like we feel a little draft around the windows, or some of us feel a lot of draft around the windows. We say, ah, the windows are leaking. And if you have an old house, good chance the windows are leaking, but it's not the window itself. And everybody, I see people caulking windows and putting plastic over the windows. Problem is, that's not where the leak is. It's behind the trim on the sides of the windows, kind of beyond the window. If you tear the place out and have a look at it, you see the pockets where the old weights, you know, go up and down in some of the older windows. Mm-hmm. Those pockets are often just, you know, wide open to the outdoors, or almost wide open to the outdoors. You can't see them from outside, but there's outside air behind the facade of the house nonetheless. There's places like that, plumbing and electrical penetrations that go up through the roof and down near where the house meets the ground is an area where there can be a lot of problems. Chimneys are big ones. A lot of us have old chimneys in our houses that are not used, but they're not sealed, and they're just like a big thermal suction. And you don't feel it because the air is going out. It's not coming in. So mm-hmm. you tend to, the air is, and where the air is coming in to make up for that air that's going up the chimney is in our walls and places. By the time it gets to our body or gets in our personal space, it's already been heated. We've had to pay to heat that. But nonetheless, we don't tend to feel it. And what we don't feel, we don't notice. That's this whole idea of pressure-driven infiltration that happens in our leaking houses. What causes this infiltration is just a pressure difference caused by wind and temperature difference and all sorts of environmental effects. But our bodies don't sense pressure difference as well as we sense temperature difference.
Mm-hmm. So in a lot of cases, we may have a draft going. That air is pulling air in low, and it's pulling it out high, and so you're getting a draft going from through the basement or maybe around the floors of the first floor, and it's pulling that up through the house and out somewhere in the top.
Right, and out somewhere else. Yeah, and usually it tends to sort of pull it, come in low and leave high. Although it really just depends on wind and all kinds of these different little micro environments that occur around your house. But the sill plate and the band joist around the bottom part of the house is a big problem. One area to look for in framing that I often say, well, it could be a problem here, and this in fact was exactly the situation on my house, was where a part of a second floor might cantilever over or stick out over the wall of a first floor. So you've got some framing that comes that's the ceiling of the first floor goes out beyond the wall and is holding up part of the second floor. And a lot of times there are holes between those framing members that are not filled in. That was what happened with mine. I tore out a little bit of a porch ceiling and just found these about 6 holes of 1 square foot each. And that's where this, you know, cold wind was hitting me in the face halfway through my house. I tore the ceiling out and looked up stuck my head up, and all of a sudden I'm getting, you know, 15-degree air one night blowing me in the face pretty hard. And I thought, whoa, what's going on here? You know, that's been happening. My house is almost 100 years old. That's been happening for that whole time. Hmm. There's other places wherever you have missing plaster. Cabinets and soffits are a big area where behind cabinets and soffits sometimes there's really not a lot of blocking or place for the places where air can be stopped. Attic accesses are one. You know, a lot of us have attic accesses in our house. Recessed lights in mm-hmm. even in newer houses, you know, recessed lights, outlets. A lot of us have felt, you know, cold air coming in through the outlets. Well, that's just saying that somehow cold air is getting into the walls of your home through poor construction.
Let me give our telephone numbers here. I don't think I did the beginning. We're certainly inviting questions. Our guest is Larry Lister from Facility Dynamics Engineering. Every once in a while he's here, we talk about home energy and where the energy goes, how we waste it, what we can do about that. And if you have questions, specific questions about your own home, you can give us a call. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And I live in an old house, and the basement is very cold. The first floor is pretty cold. The second floor is okay. And now after having gone over this territory with you, I'm starting to think, you know, I should go down in the basement and look at the walls there and look at, sort of get into a position where I can see, and it's something that I really never thought very much about, but I'm sure that there must be cold air just sailing right up from the basement into the wall and going right up at least into the first floor, if not more.
Yeah, a lot of the time that is the case, and it's funny that, you know, you'll go down, and once you start looking for this stuff, you just think, How did I miss this?
Yeah.
You know, cobwebs are, I love going down some of these old basements because I'll look at the cobwebs and I'll watch those. And a lot of times those can tell the story of what's happening.
I got plenty of those, too. we have several callers now. Let's talk with them. We'll start with a caller in Belgium, and that's line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to touch on a slightly different topic if we can.
Sure.
Yesterday, Mr. Inge had an interview with a gentleman that talked about electricity. And today we're hearing a bit more about fuel cells. There's a place in Paris, Illinois, that produces fuel cell. I don't know if it's commercially available or not, but they are working on it. Do you know anything about this kind of appliance, if we want to call it that?
I know enough to be dangerous, but not enough to be an expert. There is a guy in town, actually.
Champaign-Urbana?
Yeah, in Champaign-Urbana, works for the Army Corps of Engineers, Dr. Mike Binder,
mm-hmm.
who's very much an expert in fuel cells, and it's a really interesting area. And it's an area that's really poised to go.
Yeah, because it provides not only heat, but also electricity for you.
Right, and it does so without any major pollution involved.
Yeah.
I mean, these things put off.
You don't need a chimney.
No, there's close to magic as I think we're going to get. Now, the situation with fuel cells that I can tell you is, without getting into the technology of what happens, the electrochemical kinds of stuff that's going on in there, is that these things make electricity, and commercially, they are becoming quite viable in a lot of applications. So you're seeing them in more commercial buildings as a fuel source. They become a way for a building to supply a part of its own electricity and get some heat as well. You get some heat as a byproduct. The big thing for this show anyway, we talk residential. There are residential versions of these things that are right there, poised, ready to go. The costs. They're actually there technically. The costs are a little bit outrageous.
What sort of price range are the costs involved?
You know what? I couldn't tell you. I know that they're outrageous not in terms of absolute dollar cost, but in terms of dollar cost for what you get back out of it.
Oh, I see. You don't produce a lot of electricity.
Not necessarily. Or if you do produce a lot of electricity, you pay a lot of money. So it's just that relative.
I see.
Difference that you know, in terms of like dollars per kilowatt hour that you're going to get out of the thing, it's cheaper to hook up to the power company. Now, again, that's kind of changing. And if you live in California, or somewhere like California, which could be maybe any of us here at some point.
Yeah, we could be in that position real quick.
Well, hopefully not, but it's probably not inconceivable. what happens then is that you get the idea of reliability. Now, we're pretty addicted to this electricity stuff. It's kind of cool, and we like to have it. And when it's not there, life gets kind of nasty. When you start looking at a fuel cell from that perspective, if you start having, you know, rolling blackouts and things, then you start getting intangibles in addition to the fact that, okay, is it cheaper than what I'm getting from my utility? You start looking at, well, at least I can get electricity.
Now, this uses natural gas or something of some sort of biomass that produces the methane or whatever it does as a fuel source, right?
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah, and then there's you know, it's a chemical, electrochemical process that occurs.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Okay, let's go to Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I have a related question with heating in my apartment. I live in a very old condominium in Urbana, and it's a building that is around 50 years old, and the heating system here in the apartments is with through pipes that carry the steam water. And the problem that I have is it's terribly, terribly hot. I have to sleep with the windows open and the fan going on. And there is a boiler that regulates the heat for all the apartments. And I remember when they opened up the system, the heating when the winter began, I could hear the pounding sound of the pipes of the steam coming up, and very loud noises. And it got to the point with when the pipe broke, one of the pipes. I mean, there is no heat in one of the rooms because the pipe is broken, and I'm afraid to move the bulb. So I call the association and let them know that I have this problem. And they say that they don't have to do anything with it because my assumption is that they can regulate the heat through the boiler there. And they say that, no, that is the problem with the valves in my apartment. And I just don't know what to do. I probably am going to get someone to check them. It's very, very expensive, but I just don't know what would you recommend with this. Is it really that they cannot do anything about it, or that I got the problem, I just solve it by getting someone to come and check it out?
I think in general, the information that they gave you was correct. It sounds like it's a large steam boiler, and you've got steam radiators because you were hearing the noise, and that occurs from, that's a sort of a common part of steam heating system. There's the way that the heat should be regulated in your apartment would be at a radiator, but per, you know, by each radiator there's a valve.
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah, there's a valve there, and there's often they're not very operable, or they're mm-hmm. totally inoperable, or they're broken. That's mm-hmm. that's a pretty common occurrence as well, because a lot of this stuff is fairly old. Mm-hmm. There are new valves that are newer technology valves that are available that allow you to. They're called. It operates off of a thermostat, a little integral thermostat, and you can set it, and it will regulate the amount of steam in the apartment. So that's really. I think that's what they were telling you. You needed. Now I don't know how you're set up as far as whether that becomes your cost or whether it's their cost because it's part of the. The common building system. You would have to check into your lease or your.
No, this is a common property. It's owned. It's a condominium, but I own the condominium, and they say that anything inside the house is my responsibility.
Interesting.
But I don't know because, this is part, as you said, part of the common property too. Because this is. Regulates the system, or this is not only me, it's for the whole six apartments in this building.
Right. There's six units in the building?
Yes, uh-huh.
You know, how do you pay your heating? Does everybody pool together and pay?
Yeah, some money, correct. That's the way. It's part of the condominium fees are paid through for that, for the heating and water. And I pay part of it for electricity myself, too.
Okay.
Separate bill.
Really, if there's only six units in the building, again, without looking at it, the main caveat.
Only in this building, but there are other there are 10 buildings in total.
Oh, there's 10 buildings on the one boiler?
No, I think there are I think there are three boilers.
All right. Yeah. The quick solution is to have a heating plumbing contractor come in and put these valves on each of your radiators. Yeah. It's not a terribly expensive thing, although hourly rates for any kind of skilled labor is fairly expensive, but you sure don't want to do this yourself.
No, I don't. I wouldn't know. I mean, I work with books, and I don't know how to do all of these things at home. Another thing, do you have anyone in mind that you could recommend, or this is not supposed to for you to say on?
Yeah, I'm probably. I mean, I know there's a number of people you could look in the in the phone book, or you could probably.
And one that starts with S.
sure. Yeah. I
think we probably wouldn't want to give recommendations on the air.
Okay.
If you want to talk about it off the air, that's okay by me.
Yeah, you could. Facility Dynamics is in the phone book. You could probably give me a call and we could talk about it there. But this isn't something that there's only one person in town that can do. It's a fairly standard procedure, and you'd want to get like a Danfoss is one brand. There's a number of other brands, but one of these balancing valve, control valve actually, and have that put in, and it shouldn't be too terribly expensive.
Okay. Well, I appreciate very much what you are saying, and thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
I would think she would not be the only person in her building having that problem. They should all get together and give somebody to give them a discount to do the whole place.
You know, and whoever is responsible, if it's a group that's responsible for paying that bill, they would do well. This would be a money-saving thing over a fairly short amount of time.
Well, then the agenda for the next meeting of the condominium association.
Right, just go through and do the whole place, sweep through and do the whole place.
But midway through here, our guest is Larry Lister. He's an engineer. His business is Facility Dynamics Engineering, and he is particularly interested in energy efficiency and design, construction, operation of buildings. And every once in a while he's here. We talk about energy in the home, where it goes, and how to keep the bills low and the comfort level up where you want it. We thought it'd be a good time to have him come back here because we're still, some people are probably still in shock over the over the bills. I mean, we
including
have
me.
an old house. It's a little old house, but it's an old house, and we were over $300 on that one month. So yeah, I knew it was going to be big. I just didn't think it would be like that. I was pretty shocked myself.
Mm.
So let's go to Peoria here for a caller. Line two. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Hello.
What do you think of this geothermal system that they have that they pump cold air in the summertime and hot air in the wintertime?
Yeah, the ground source or water source heat pumps, I think, is what we're talking about.
Right.
Yeah, we've hit this topic a number of times, and my sort of standard take is from a technology perspective, it's great equipment. As a mechanical engineer, the equipment's just great, and what it is at the risk of oversimplification, it's an air conditioner that can also run backwards, so it can kind of do both jobs. There's a reversing valve in it, and it just kind of decides which one you want to do today, and it does it.
Well, my son had it put in. He just built a new home over in Morton last year. And the contractor said that the payback time is 7.5 years.
Yeah.
Quite expensive. I think it was $15,000.
Right. That's about what they're not cheap. It's been a while since I've done the numbers, and with the energy prices changing the way they are, I could possibly stand to be corrected here, but I'll give you this my standard thing. If you live south of about, southern Illinois, southern Indiana, and down, heat pumps are pretty much the standard way to do things. If you're in a climate that doesn't require a lot of heating that is more predominantly cooling, they become more and more efficient. If you get down into Tennessee and south, it's getting fairly uncommon to even see air conditioners anymore. I mean, they're all heat pumps are just what goes into homes nowadays. The problem with that is, and there's a bunch of different ways to do it, and there's some that get really expensive that use natural gas as well as electricity. But with the standard sort of heat pump technology, you're using electricity to heat your house. And the power companies love it, or they used to love it. What happens is once you start getting below about 36, 37 degrees outside, the heat pump can't extract much heat out of that cold air. Again, I'm really, other engineers are probably just cringing as I talk about this, but this is what seems to work discussion-wise. It can't take much more heat out of that cold air. Therefore, it has to start going to some other source of heat. That could be on a cheaper unit that becomes electric resistance. On an expensive, more expensive unit, there's a natural gas furnace that you buy in addition to the heat pump. So you've got all these different things working in combination. Again, technology-wise, they've worked it out that this stuff works great.
Do you ever think about how much your water heater uses gas in a year's time?
Yeah, I've thought about it.
I'll tell you what I did when my heater went out. I got another heater, 40 gallons, and I took the lid off. And I put little pieces of wood in so that it would still be round. And I put 35 square feet of insulation inside of this water heater. And you would be amazed how much this insulation keeps the water hot and it doesn't kick in.
Great. Sounds good.
Well, thanks for the call. There was a time, I think, when there seemed to be more interest in insulating water heaters. Mm-hmm. You could buy a jacket mm-hmm. to ground the water heater. And maybe, again, that was one of those things that sort of, as prices came down, as we became sort of less concerned about energy use, people weren't going around looking for every place they could save just a tiny bit. Now maybe people are going to start thinking about that again.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of this stuff is going to start rearing its head again, and some of it's good and some of it's bad. The water heater jackets, those are still available, and they're out there. And one reason that they've become a little bit less pronounced is that the Department of Energy over the last 8 or so, 10 years has implemented a lot of standards and appliances, and you see these yellow stickers on everything. Well, those yellow stickers are pretty good. They really serve a useful purpose. And in the case of water heaters, there's ratings for those as well as there is for air conditioners and everything else. And what they've done is they start rating them. So the free market has started to take over a little bit the fact that if somebody makes a water heater with a little bit more insulation, the sticker will reflect the lower energy use of that, and people that are looking for that particular, that are interested in that can buy it. The jackets are still available for the older water heaters that are out there that people may want to insulate. You don't really hear much about it, but natural gas was so relatively inexpensive for so long that a lot of people weren't too terribly concerned about the amount of fuel that they're.
So it sounds like if you were going to go out today and buy a new high efficiency water heater, buy a good, not necessarily the most expensive one you can find, but buy a good one. You might not gain anything. Sounds like.
Well, it depends on again. It's really you need to watch those stickers. The sticker really kind of tells the story. Same with a refrigerator too. A refrigerator is a huge energy consuming device in our homes. It used to be a lot huger than it is. The technology has gotten great in those areas. Refrigerators use a fraction of what they used 10, 15 years ago. But the sticker really will tell the story. It doesn't, don't use that number as a guideline for how much it's really going to cost you, because the tests are all done under, controlled conditions. But they're all done the same. So if you're shopping for a refrigerator or a water heater, and you see a, it's not uncommon to find a $650 refrigerator that uses, $55 a year worth of electricity, and to find another one sitting right next to it that looks, can look virtually identical, same size and everything, that uses $36 worth of energy a year. And maybe that amount isn't important to you. Maybe it is. There's another, with the refrigerator thing, there's another part of the story, is that that refrigerator, all that electricity is converted to heat in your house. And so in the summer when you're trying to cool, you're an inefficient refrigerator is also
just generating,
throwing a little more heat in the house. Yeah. You've got to take care of that too. So,
well, let's take some other calls here. We'll go to Glen Ellen, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. In my condo, I know I'm going to have to replace the 4 windows, and I know the style of windows I need to be in accordance with the association rules, and I know the approximate price, and I've picked out some seemingly honest contractors. Since it's a $3,600 job, I still wonder, though, from a consumer standpoint, what's the best procedure to protect myself? For example, should there be a contract? Should there be a certain percentage I should pay up front? How can I best protect myself?
Boy, that's...
Or just check out the contractor thoroughly.
Yeah, I would just check out the contractor. I mean, this it's actually...
Construction problems are a big source of complaint, to consumer groups.
Yeah, they are.
The job is not done right, it's not completed on time, or something is substandard.
Yeah, word of mouth is actually a fairly good indicator. It's a little easier for us to say down here in Champaign, because it's a fairly smaller community and word gets around fast.
Would I be advised to try to get from them other customers they've worked with?
Yeah, that's the one I like to use, frankly. I just say, hey, can you give me the name? And you don't want to pressure them. Actually, prices go up dramatically if you are if a contractor perceives a client or a potential customer as somebody that's going to be a big problem, the prices start going up fast.
So you want to be
fairly cool about it, and I would say with a contractor, definitely innocent until proven guilty. Assume that you're dealing with good people, and then until you find out otherwise.
The scenario that I wouldn't want would be he would start out, and then all of a sudden a more lucrative job comes along, so he puts my job off for a couple weeks or months.
Well, how big a job is this? How many windows?
Well, it's all the windows in my condo. It's 4 windows, but since they're rather expensive windows, pretty much everyone has quoted me $3,600.
Yeah.
Still a pretty good chunk of cash.
Yeah, it is. I'll kind of go back to the energy thing. Are you doing what's precipitating the you wanting new windows?
Well, the old windows, I've paid a gentleman several hundred dollars to adjust them and get them in good shape, but they're in dreadful condition and they probably should have been replaced. So he would have been advised to tell me to replace them, but I think he wanted the work, so he said, "Oh, I can fix them up."
Yeah.
Well, now I realize that they shouldn't have been fixed up. They should have been replaced. So I've already lost those couple hundred dollars in his tinkering.
Yeah. Are they?
They have to be casement windows, and they're probably going to have to be an Anderson brand window, because in a condo association you're restricted with a homogeneity of the units.
Yeah.
So I mean, pretty much that's the price I've gotten from 3 or 4 contractors. So now I'm just to the point where I choose which contractor looks like it's going to be the best.
Right.
But I don't want to end up I'm not a wealthy individual. I don't want to end up the butt of a construction scam.
No, I'd say your chances of that are pretty low. If you got prices from 3 or 4 different people, that and they're all within the ballpark, I think what you could do is then ask them, say, "Hey, could you just give me the name of a couple other people that you've done this for that wouldn't mind, checking and seeing how everything went, make sure it went okay?"
Yeah, would I possibly even be better just going through the manufacturer of the windows that they're going to use and say, "Are these guys okay?"
I'm not sure they would know. I'd say you're almost better off, trying to talk to some other clients. And again, it really depends on how you approach it. At least that's my take on it. Is if you just say, "Hey, could you?" And the ones that don't want to respond with that are probably people you'd want to stay away from. The other thing that I've found is that your gut instinct is worth listening to as well. You know, if you've had to deal with two or three, four contractors getting back to you, you know, you probably have a bit of a, I'm not talking about, you know, who is a nice guy or whatever, but just somebody that seems like they're kind of conscientious. And
Yeah. Well, I'd rather have a guy who's doing the job right rather than a nice guy.
Yeah.
Even if he's a little persnickety, I don't mind if he does the job correctly.
Right. So I just say use your gut instinct and ask for references.
Okay.
That's
thank you very much.
Definitely that's good practice.
All right. Thanks
for your help.
For the call.
Thank you.
Let's go back here to someone locally. Next it'll be Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi. I heard the initial conversation about energy efficiency and so forth, and I have a story and a caveat. Our house was built at a time when energy prices were pretty high, and the people who built our house basically made it really tight, so we've enjoyed low power bills through the years. However, and this is where the caveat comes in, they essentially made the house too tight. They didn't allow for proper ventilation and so forth, and so we're going to have to replace the roof somewhat prematurely, and we are going to have to replace some boards on the siding and the area where the deck meets the house has had some moisture buildup and problems, so we're going to have to spend money on that as well. So the caveat is that especially for people who are do-it-yourselfers, don't make the house super energy efficient. It probably is worth spending money for a consultant to at least come out and assess whether or not you have put in too much insulation, because a house has to be allowed to breathe and so forth, because in our case, what we've saved in energy through the years, we are now going to have to spend to have problems fixed, things that, you know, we never dreamed of. You know, when we bought the house, we were told, oh, you know, it's nice and tight and energy efficient and so forth and so on. But as I say, now we're going to have to pay the piper to repair the damage done by a too tight house.
Interesting points. And my response is that I think a lot of what you said is something that people should heed. However, my take on it from the physics perspective is that I see this happen fairly often, is that a lot of problems with structural things and different things that happen do get pinned on a too tight house. And I hear that, you know, people say a lot and have the impression that a house needs to breathe and things like that. There's certain specific things that could be the case and that could be causing this that were done due to energy efficiency and due to something that was done wrong at the design or at the construction phase. Mm-hmm. It's fairly, I maintain it's fairly rare that those problems are due to the energy efficient nature of the house. That
well,
if you've got some
roof, the vents which I had gone around and opened and closed during what I thought were the proper seasons, when we had somebody go down and investigate the efficiency and so forth, apparently they had actually used polyurethane foam over the vent openings, so that when I went around and opened and closed them, it actually was doing no good because they were closed shut.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, we were told that basically they trapped the moisture in the crawl space rather than letting it the excess moisture sort of escape.
Yeah, and again, that some of that, you know, there it could be misapplication. So what you're saying could be the case. A lot of times, I see, as often as not, I see a lot of vents and things put in by people and contractors that are putting them in because they always did, because they thought they should be there, and in fact, they're really not doing any good. And in a lot of cases, and this is something Bill Rose, who's another guest on this show, occasionally talks about architecture and things. Bill is quite the national expert on attic mm-hmm. breathing, or in this case, not breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of interesting, and you know, it's one of those devils in the details. There's a lot of
sure.
things. And there's a lot of people will say, well, you know, the house isn't breathing and I've got all these problems and I've got stuff rotting and so forth. But in a lot of cases, when you really look at it, it's sometimes it's not the fact, you know, house doesn't need to breathe. We do and in the house. And that's the issue that you didn't mention, but that I would want to add to this, that you can make a house too tight. And the bad impact, if the house is designed right, the house will stand up just fine and you won't have problems. But what you would have problems with is breathing and, you know, being comfortable inside and smelling last week's fish dinner, and which all happens in a house that's too tight, that doesn't get enough ventilation.
Well, we have like an electrostatic air filter on the furnace and so forth, so we don't have those kinds of problems or anything. But you know, as I say, we have had to deal with this excess moisture in the crawl space and so forth. But
it sounds like it was, in this case, you know, that there probably was misapplication of a thermal boundary, which is when you spray urethane, which is an excellent, excellent insulator.
Mm-hmm.
And it does a lot. It does a good job for the air tightness as well. There's a guy in town doing it now. For years, you couldn't find anybody to do it for the last few years, and there's somebody now back in business doing it. But it's a great thing. But if it was done at the wrong place, and which could be the case in where you're talking about, then yeah, it is a misapplication of a good technology.
Anyway, thanks very much for the
sure.
program.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks
well,
for the
certainly
point.
The point is well taken that in our daily living we do all kinds of things that generate moisture. We cook. We take showers. We do laundry.
We breathe.
And we breathe, and that you do have to make sure that gets vented, because you can get into a situation where your moisture levels are so high that not only maybe are you uncomfortable, but you get the worst problem where you get condensation places that you don't want it, and then you get windowsills rotting out and
right.
you know, all kinds of things, or the kind of issues the caller brought mm-hmm. up. So it definitely is something that you need to need to think
mold
about.
On the walls is another one you see a lot in a super insulated house where it's insulated, everything's great, where the wood stud thermally bridges through the wall, you get these lines on the wall, which happens if there's not enough insulation on the exterior side, and you start to see these little dark shadows of your framing, and yeah, a little disconcerting.
Well, let's go to southeastern Illinois here for somebody else. Line 4. Hello.
Yes, another problem with too tight a house is volatile plastic things that can cause allergies. New rugs and things like that, I've read. But I hate to ask you to go over this again, but you had just started to talk about water heaters when I had someone come in and I couldn't hear what you were saying. What did you have to say about water heaters?
Oh, we were talking about the efficiency standards on water heaters and the fact that, like a lot of other appliances, you can shop for a water heater based on whatever you want to shop for, if you want to get the size or the technology, but you can always look at the energy use, and there's ratings on those that are pretty accurate, so you can compare one against the other and decide.
Do those vary greatly? I mean,
you know,
a gas water heater.
Yeah, on a gas water heater, they vary greatly. There's two types of, there's two sort of technologies. Within each technology band, they don't vary a whole lot. The one is the standard natural convection type water heater with the stack that goes up the middle. That most of us are familiar with. The other is the newer technology that has an induced draft fan. It's kind of a power ventilated.
Now, is that the one that has to be ventilated through the wall or something?
Yeah, that goes through the wall as opposed to going up out the stack. And I think some of them now, even the natural ones, I think are starting to try to side vent those.
What did you have happen to know off the top of your head? What the range is in the two different types?
How
much difference there is between them?
Boy, I've got something here that I could look it up, but given the fact that we're like within a minute,
a couple of minutes,
I probably wouldn't be able to do it. Okay. There's a book. I should mention this. I haven't mentioned it in a while. There's a book that you can get at any of the bookstores. That's a really useful little book to have. It's about $6 or $7, $8, and it's written by the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. ACEEE is what it's called. And they put it out about every other year, and it's got listings of all the efficient products and things in it, as well as just some really nice, simple, to-the-point rules and things. And a lot of what you hear me talk about, you could see and reference in this book as well. It's called The Consumer Guide to Home Energy Savings.
Hmm. Well, thank you.
And it's usually Alex Wilson is one of the authors from year to year, but occasionally there's other people that do it.
Now, what's the title again?
Consumer Guide to Home Energy Savings.
Thank you.
Let's go.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, we could put that up on the website. On the website.
Yeah, and we probably should. That would be a good idea. We'll try and see if we can do one more here. Urbana, line two.
I have an older home which has a great deal of cement blocks from the basement above ground, several feet.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if I could glue some kind of insulation onto the walls, and if I did, what would be the fire hazard, and does it have to go all the way to the floor? Or if I can't glue, then what can I do?
The answer is yes, and I'm trying to remember if there was three questions in there, too. I don't know that you need to go to the floor, but is the basement finished? Or
it's just cement blocks, but it's been painted with something. I don't know what kind of paint the people ahead of me painted the walls white.
Yeah, the best way to do it would be to try to get it from the outside. That would be the first thing to try to do. That gets into, somebody having to come in and dig it out a little bit, dig around the foundation. But to get it from the outside would be one way to really take care of it without getting into a bunch of other questions and things. This could get into a detailed thing. There's, you might just talk to a couple contractors and have them take a look at it and see what they would consider doing. And I think there could be a code issue. I don't know about Champaign, but there may be one in Urbana that might dictate how you would need to do that. But it wouldn't be a major deal on the code.
So the better
code
way to do it from an energy standpoint is to do it from the outside?
From a comfort standpoint, yeah. Yeah. And from longevity, if you stop the problem on the outside, number one, you can go down, you don't have to go the whole way down. You can just get you can get the worst of it near ground level, the first 18 inches or 2 feet, without going all the way down to the floor, and then you haven't disturbed your inside walls, as well as the walls will then, you're better off stopping it from the out, putting the thermal barrier at the outside versus at the inside.
Okay.
From a dew point, and I'm saying this more from a dew point perspective.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to stop. I appreciate the call, and thanks to everybody who called in. I'm sure on another day we'll do this again. But for a moment, we say thanks to Larry Lister from Facility Dynamics Engineering for being here. Thanks.
See you.